I'm Phil Brining. I'm joined by Dave Holmes and Ollie Rea and Kathy. First off, let's have a chat through what's been in the news, Dave and Ollie. One of the couple of things that I noticed on the ICO's website, I'm going to try and take all the easy stuff, the low-hanging fruit here first. I noticed another custodial sentence for people stealing data from their employer. Did you see that on the ICO's website?
I did, yes. It relates to an employee with the RAC, wasn't it? passing on to claims management.
Yeah, 8 months suspended, but still an 8 months custodial sentence. Again, this is the second time, only the second time, that they've put people in jail or the courts have issued custodial sentences for data protection misdemeanors. So that's interesting to get. They're very notable because they're rare, aren't they?
It is. And I also think offences now are disclosable offences, aren't they? So I think if you, if I'm right, I think when the guy next goes out to find a job, it'll pop up on his DBS check that he's been selling data. So it might kind of inhibit his opportunities somewhat.
Well, it's worth reminding all our employees, not trying to scare them, but reminding people that, you know, you taking data from your employer and you know, in my experience, people do it, you know, think it's theirs, have accumulated it over the course of their employment, particularly salespeople, dare I say. They think it's a right to take it on, but in technically it is theft. I mean, if you try and resell it and reuse it, then, you know, you're gonna potentially get into trouble. And as I say, this is the second time the ICO has issued a custodial, or the courts have issued a custodial sentence on the back of this.
I think it's absolutely valid, and I think training material should cover off highlighting to individuals. I know I cover it with some of the training that I do, that I go through some of the offences and highlight some of the offences that's promoted or at least published on the ICO's website. And that they are out there, and the best way to avoid them is to stay in line with your organisation's policies and procedures or your internal rules, because that's going to be your in essence your safety net. So read them and comply to them.
Yeah. What did you notice in the news, Ollie or Dave? Ollie.
Whichever. I picked up on a judgment handed down by the CNIL. As you know, I always scour the CNIL's website before these sessions, see if there's.
That's
anything
the French regulator, isn't it?
Yeah, the French Data Protection Authority. And recently, they've handed down a decision relating to the French equivalent of the Home Office. Because the French police have been using surveillance drones to firstly monitor people during the lockdown in Paris and make sure that people aren't breaking lockdown. And then secondly, they've been using it as part of some of the protests that have been going on across France over the last few months. And the CNIL have found that, I mean, it breaches a whole series of provisions of the GDPR, notably the fact that a DPIA hasn't been conducted or communicated to them subsequently, issues over proportionality, obviously, issues over sort of intrusive monitoring, the fact that a lot of people who were recognisable weren't blurred at an early enough stage, just a whole series of issues. And what's interesting is obviously the CNIL don't have the power to fine the Home Office. It's not something they can do, but they have handed down this decision, which is asking them to stop immediately, and to they're going to be launching a sort of thorough investigation into all this. I thought it was really quite interesting because it throws up a lot of different issues.
Yeah, any more?
For me, I also found, I don't know if you came across, it's probably nearly a week ago now, just an article in the BBC about smart locks and the fact that the convenience of them comes with security doubts. And this was in relation to smart locks on your home, so you can then use your mobile device to unlock and lock your homes in the same way that you could use Hive devices to turn on or turn off your heating before you get home from work. And all the implications of that, I just found that quite an interesting article. I don't know if anybody else kind of caught that towards either the end of last week or the early part of this week.
No, yeah, I caught that, and definitely interesting in terms of the way we're going on things. I'll tell you something that happened to me this week, Dave, which I don't know if I told you about this, but a client we've been working with, a housing provider, this week got a communication from a solicitor on behalf of one of
their clients. I was going to raise it, Ollie. Yeah.
And a sort of first, you know, well, one of the first instances that we've seen really of this sort of new PPI style ambulance chasing data breach claim. So basically what had happened is that the data subject had put in a SAR to our client, the housing provider. They, for all intents and purposes, had fulfilled it perfectly, not even just adequately. They'd given them absolutely everything. As far as I'm aware, it wasn't even a particularly contentious SAR. There was nothing, you know, overly redacted, anything like that. And anyway, they get a letter a couple of months later saying, you've committed a data breach. Okay, good start. By not complying with our client's subject access request. In particular, you've not complied with Article 28.3E of the GDPR. Now, as some of you may or may not know, Article 28 relates to processes specifically. 28.3E is the requirement to have in your processing agreements a clause which obliges processes to help controllers with subject access requests in particular. So we've read this and gone, well, that's clearly irrelevant. That's nothing to do with it. I think you probably best sort of reassess where you think you're taking this claim. And, you know, we'll do a thorough search for information if there's anything you think we've missed. But we think you're a bit misguided here. But I thought it was interesting that this is, at least from my perspective, one of the first instances I've really seen of this. I don't know if either of you or any of you on the call have started to come across these types of claims.
Well, the other thing, Ollie, is you kind of rebutted them on the personal data breach the claim as well, didn't you? Saying, well, you know, whatever's happened doesn't fall into the definition of a personal data breach. But I mean, this letter from the lawyers was just bamboozling, wasn't it, really? Because it was absolutely incredibly ill-informed, or it would seem to be ill-informed, yeah, and couldn't really see where they were going with it.
No, you're absolutely right.
But I think
right.
There's going to be more cases of these arising.
No, definitely.
I've certainly seen a lot. And on the kind of claim management companies, you only have to Google personal data breach and you get a whole host of them. And unless you sort your tracking cookies out, you'll then be bombarded with them on any social media platforms that you're operating on. So you see them because I'd also seen them advertising on Facebook. So I clicked on there to have a look on Facebook. They're regularly coming up now. A multitude of different claims management companies all trying to push the wares on social media and things about personal data breaches. In essence, so it is coming. I know the industry was talking about will data breaches be the next PPI and things like that. And it certainly looks like it's getting traction that way because of the amount of money claims management companies are now spending in that area.
Yeah, I tell you a couple of the things. Sorry, go on, Ollie, and I'll.
I tell you what, Dave, I've not just seen it on social media because I've also seen a huge amount of these sort of targeted ads for data breaches. That's possibly because I'm Googling data breaches anyway. But I've even seen...
Yeah, you're getting remarketed.
Remarketed, yeah. but I've even seen adverts for claims management companies in relation to this, you know, on primetime TV. You know, really sort of like prime hour slots.
CTV
adverts for it is, yeah.
There must be good money in it. Yeah. Couple other bits. Kathy is chomping a bit to dive in, but I don't know if you know, it's the ICO company sending out answers to, and they're interesting to read the judgments really, because they explain why consent, you know, that the company thought they had wasn't valid. So by looking at a few of these cases, you really piece together the way the ICO thinks in this. So that's the way I think about it, and it's really, you know, it's an area where some of our customers, really not the social housing guys but the commercial guys, they really struggle with this, don't they, and fall foul of it very. At the ICO is action, you know, you test what you've got against the action they've taken against people, you think actually we haven't got demonstrable consent in the spirit of how it's going to get interpreted. Did you see those couple of fines? I think one was who was it now? I can't remember who it was now. It was OSL OSL financial services company. But again, that was unsolicited text going out. Did you see any of those? maybe not. A couple of other things in the news as well. Interesting, the European Data Protection Board yesterday sent out a press statement saying they had adopted the two sets of standard contractual clauses that they published in November, which were the Article 28 ones for processors and the Article 46 ones for international transfers. So I should imagine, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, the ICO will adopt these as well. And we've then got a year to review our international transfers contracts, particularly because I don't think the Article 28 ones have changed, but they're the official ones issued by the European Data Protection Board. But the Article 46 ones, definitely for transfers, have changed significantly. So we're going to have to repaper our contracts, I would have thought. What, did you see that, Dave?
I did, I read it. I think it's, you're right, I think the European Data Protection Board and the European Data Protection Supervisor have put a joint opinion out about it. I think they recommended it to the Commission, and it's just waiting for the Commission to approve it. But I think that's just going to be a rubber stamp process, quite frankly. Yeah. With regards to the ICO, well, I would imagine quite strongly that they would just follow suit. Because for a consistency mechanism.
Well, nothing wrong with them, is there?
There's nothing wrong with them. And for consistency purposes, you'll get to where we're using your standard contractual clauses or ours, and you kind of go for consistency. Let's just use one set. It would make more economic sense to do that than to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. A couple of other bits. The ICO, again, today have just announced they're going to pick up the baton again on investigating the ad tech industry. So all this remarketing, we're talking about Ollie getting remarketed, data breach claims, you know, all of that technology behind that real-time bidding for slots. The ICO was investigating it and put it on hold in May due to COVID pressures, but now they've announced today they're going to pick it back up again. So not entirely sure where that's going to end up, but certainly I would have thought much greater regulation of the use of cookies and tracking pixels. I think we were talking about these last week, weren't we, on this session. Tracking pixels and those kind of things. And I sent you a case to look at, Dave, as well this morning, or a news story about a case where the extraterritoriality of the UK GDPR that's being tested in the English courts. And this guy was saying, well, this firm in America, a court by the UK GDPR, and the court ruled they weren't because there wasn't sufficient substance to their operations in the UK. Have you had a chance to track that down yet?
I've actually got it in my reading list. I'd seen that, and I was going to raise it this afternoon, but I've just not had time to get around to read it. But I had read it because it's the decision by the High Court, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So it's not the highest court in the land, but it's a decision by the High Court. But it'll be certainly quite interesting to see what that may mean.
Yeah, and final one here is, I don't know if anybody has seen this, but our latest recruit, Matthew, wrote, I thought, a fantastic blog yesterday. We were asked as a support ticket to try and help map out the UK GDPR, in fact, the GDPR and the Data Protection Act. And the customer who'd asked the question was saying, look, I'm trying to find what we've got to do with records of processing activities. And the only place I can find them in the Data Protection Act is Section 61, which, of course, is in the Law Enforcement Directive piece, Part 3 of the, so therefore not applicable at all unless you're a law enforcement agency. So anyway, in order to try and help this customer understand how it all works, Matthew did a lot of digging around, and I thought wrote a fantastic piece about that, including a graphic illustration of how the articles in the UK GDPR are supported by or linked to or expanded in the Data Protection Act, and then how the schedules then build on top of that. So if you haven't seen that, it's well worth going to have a look at it. And again, a superb piece of work there from him. Right, anything else, Ollie and Dave, before we ask Cathy to illuminate us on SARS?
I'm happy now for Cathy to take the lead.
Right. Okay, so I'll try and illuminate you all. So
what we're talking about, Cathy, I think is you know what we've learned in our SAR Bureau about how to make it simpler, how to make it lighter work, how to make it easier to handle, how to make it kind of first time right type of stuff. So that's what we're trying to tease out. So again, if people got questions and they're not sure of what we're talking about, then either dive in or put them in the chat. Cathy, go on, give us give us some of your thoughts here on how.
So this is probably based on, you know, 18 months of experience starting to deal with SARS. And what I've tried to do today is instead of relating it just to the law, I've tried to, you know, communicate that in basic terms so that, you know, if somebody's on here that's tasked with reviewing SARS, life will be hopefully much easier. So we've called it 7 ways to simplify a subject access request. And the first one is getting the scope right. Believe it or not, we see some amazing information of, you know, what we're supposed to be looking for. And I learned quite a long time ago that getting the scope right is probably the most important part of the job. So there's two types of scoping, obviously, and two types of SAR queries. So you've got your internal type, you've got your external type. So your internal SAR is likely to be an employee. And obviously, if it's an employee, you can insist as part of your process that you actually have a SAR form, which, you know, they're entitled to fill in as an employee for, you know, whatever it is, the information they require. So, you know, I'm hoping everybody's got one of those in place. Once you actually get the SAR request, then what I think you need is an internal scoping form. Now, an internal scoping form will collate and collect all the information that you need for everybody who's going to be involved in this DSAR, including IT, who've got to then go away and look for the information. So this scoping form should have, you know, various numbers of information in there. So I'm just going to run through some things that it should include as a matter of course. You know, so a list of sources, search files, emails, HR, etc. So names of the files where IT are likely to find the information that this data subject's requiring. Are you also disclosing to, from and CC? So a decision to be made as part of your internal policy. You know, if that person's already had the emails or been copied into the emails, you know, you probably should disclose that and count it out of the scope because it's just additional work to be done. Background of the request, you know, what's been going on? You know, why do you suspect there's a SAR? The title, roles, responsibilities, email addresses, nicknames, any specific information that the reviewers need to look for. Date of the scope, you know, any dates that are in or out of scope. I mean, there's an awful long list of stuff here, so I'll try not to bore you for too long. We have sort of got this in a checklist as well, so it could be useful.
So what's the point of this, Kathy? I mean, is the point of this to try and, you know, preempt and narrowing down of the scope of the SAR, or is this about internal communication? You know, what's the benefit of getting the these forms? You know, forms are a form, yeah, but what's the point of it? What's the benefit?
Both of those. So, you know, this is in the background. So once you get a request from the subject access request and you determine, you know, yeah, we've got this, you know, clarify with the data subject exactly, you know, what it is they require. Sometimes they'll give you an idea of what they're looking for, but mostly not. Sometimes they just ask for everything. So this is trying to make sure that, you know, whoever's looking for the information and doing the review has got all the information they're required to be able to review the data. So, you know, internally, I think every company should have an internal scoping form that they use to collate all this information together.
Yeah, we've also found that the way you communicate with IT is key, isn't it? So when they're typing search terms into technology, it looks for the specific and exact phrase that you define. So if you kind of get that wrong, or, you know, it's two words and it's, you know, first name and surname rather than, you know, first name, surname. Yeah. Then, you know, then the search strings don't work. So again, we know that from our experience that you put these search terms into the technology and you get the wrong result, don't you?
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say, so your form really needs to be, you know, well thought through and tested with the IT guys so that they know and they can advise you. Well, if you're looking for, you know, this, then, you know, like for instance, a employee number, if it says employee number colon and then a string of numbers, that's what they'll look for, and they'll never find it because the employee number doesn't have a prefix of employee number colon.
Yeah, exactly. So you specifically have to think about those fields, you know, when you're putting it all into the form, as well as words of interest like, you know, health, performance, review, sick pay, Bradford factor, redundancy, capabilities, all that sort of, you know, specific words that, you know, you're looking for when you do a review, you know. So in the form, you need to, you know, make a list or, you know, maybe a tick box of words of interest that you might be looking for. So when you're doing
how does that help? How does that help us? I mean, is that so we can, when we're looking at the search results, we can say, well, this lot, you know, has got this in it and that in it and that in it, therefore it's more likely to be important, whereas this stuff that we're looking at has got, you know, one set of data in, but none of these keywords, therefore it's less likely. So does that, so you can prioritize the working of the review of the documents?
Yeah, and also to pin down, you know, the sort of information that they're looking for. So obviously if there's been a, you know, I don't know, a disciplinary or something, then, you know, some of those keywords are going to be of interest to home into, and are probably more likely for, you know, the hierarchy to want to have a look at that before they send it over to the data subject, or, you know, they want to review to see whether any of it could be caught by, you know, management forecasting, if it's a redundancy, or, you know, if it's something around negotiations or settlements, that, you know, it could affect the settlement. It, you know, if it's confidential, it could be, you know, it may be that it's going legal. So, you know, all of this information just helps to home in on the stuff that really that you're looking for, and the stuff that's going to be critical to the, you know, the management team to want to have a look at afterwards.
Yeah. So another good example would be, I guess, if any emails, for instance, have got legally privileged or legal professional privilege, or, you know, legal in confidence in them anywhere, then they might be able to be just ring fenced and put into a pot for the legal team to look at. So again, by using these keywords, you can start to manipulate the data, can't you, on a big scale before you start issuing it out for people to review. That's correct. What you're saying in part, isn't it?
Correct. And also it helps you to search and find. So, you know, if you've been asked to look at, you know, it's all around a disciplinary, then a set of, you know, words is going to identify that. It could be Bradford factor, it could be sickness, it could be just disciplinary, it could be whistleblowing, whatever. So there'll be a set of words that you can actually, depending on what software you're using, you can do a search and find for those, and then you can categorize them separately to do a, you know, a secondary review on those, and then a secondary QA, and if need be, get the client looking at it.
Yeah. I suppose that having the right tools as well, is that must be one of the critical parts of making it a simpler job. So if you're at Acton, you know, what are you using? Are you using Adobe DC, or are you using a professional platform? Are you still using paper with Tippex and marker pens? Having the right tools must be another key thing, Kathy.
Again, and, you know, lessons learned in all of those. I mean, I've seen some really poor manual redaction, you know, where whatever pen they're using is not right for the job, and you can still see the data and etc. I mean, these days, why anybody would do manual redaction, you know, for the cost of what it costs to get somebody to you know, produce that into electronic format, you know, it's probably a waste of effort. However, people still do it. You know, and obviously we've had a lot of where manual redaction's been done, particularly in schools. And then we've had to upload it electronically. And, you know, they've missed half the word out, or they've only redacted half the word, or, you know, they've highlighted words that have already gone, so you can't read them. So having the right tools is certainly important, but also having a really stringent QA process. But I'm probably stealing the thunder of, you know, some of the other aspects all along. But as an internal SAR, you should definitely have a good SAR policy, which, you know, tells you, you know, as a company, what you're going to do. So, for example, you know, some companies decide to completely redact any third parties, including their own staff, you know, name, title, contact number. Some companies want to leave in the employees because they've got a contract with them. So, you know, your policy needs to outline what it is as a company that, you know, the process that you want to follow. And obviously that has to match with the legal requirements. So everybody, you know, at the start should now have a policy and probably a procedure for SARs, and obviously some sort of scoping form as well as you.
Yeah, and we've been caught out, I mean, a couple of times where we've talked to a customer in detail about a brief, and we've agreed an approach to exactly that, you know, all third party information comes out, or stays in, you know, well, let's try and try. And then all of a sudden, halfway through a project, they say, actually, you know, we don't like the look of this. We want to take it all out now. So, you know, the rules change halfway through. We've then got to stop the team. We've got to rebrief the team. We've got to provide them with screenshots and examples of what it means in practice and what they're looking for and how to treat it. So it just delays the whole thing, doesn't it? Now, if you can get that start, what you're saying is, if you can get that set up at the start with the procedure, when you come to this type of information, treat it like this. And again, you've got the advantage, though, Kathy, that you do this on the scale, and you've done it, you know, every week. Well, you haven't, but the team's been going every week for the last 18 months dealing with SARS. So we've got an awful lot of benefit of scale and good process and learnings. But not everyone gets them, you know, and they're not. Some people are loathed to kind of prepare lots in advance and think it all through and prepare all the training. Because I might not get any SARS, I might not get a complicated SARS, but that time, in my opinion, is worth investing. Do you think so?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's so costly to the client when they change their mind halfway through. And we've had some good examples of that where, you know, they've just not liked, you know, the conversation that's been going on. And actually, that's not a reason not to disclose that information. So, you know, you've got to be really careful when you decide to hold something back. And that's obviously as a team where we come in, because we look at exemptions. You know, just because you don't like what's being said on an email doesn't mean to say that you know, that you can't disclose it. You know, the chances are most of the time you will have to disclose it. But sometimes when we start doing a SAR and we can able to give the client feedback, which we often do, we often get them on the platform, get them to see what we're seeing, then sometimes the tack does change. So really, you know, you need to really think about all these things when you're writing your policy and procedure, because, you know, that's what you should be following, and you shouldn't be deviating from your process once you decide, you know, that's how it is, and it lawfully it's being checked and signed off.
Yeah, you were talking about a QA process. I think I might have interrupted you, but you were talking about a QA process. So what is that then? How does that work? I mean, are you obviously got, are you saying you got two teams working on this, or you got one team when you swap paperwork so everything gets two eyes on it? How does the QA process work?
Yeah, we always have two eyes on everything, and sometimes even three. So it also depends on the nature of the SAR. So, you know, some of the big ones that we've had to deal with, you know, we've been asked to take legally privileged and, you know, provide that in a separate folder. We've been asked to put the business as usual in a separate folder and look at that additionally. But regardless of what it is, we have a team of QAs. And once we've got the scope right and we've started on with the job, the QAs are sort of on the job for day one. So they then deliver the scope into a PowerPoint, and every reviewer, obviously training is crucial. So then every reviewer is on the training before they start the work. And it's a good hour, couple of hours training where, you know, obviously we remind them of the data protection laws against, you know, on SAR. So they've always got a reminder. We give them examples of specifics of what we're looking for, you know, how to redact it, you know, the two from and CCs, are they provided as a matter of course? So we do a really good in-depth PowerPoint. And then obviously the team, whichever team's on it, they get off then and start reviewing. The QA follows straight behind. So the QA, as soon as things go into QA, they're QAing from day one to make sure that everything is checked and they're all following the same format. And of course, if they're not, then it's thrown back to the reviewer. And the QA will get on a Teams and talk them through any mistakes that they're making.
So
that's the same whether it's a manual process on our third party platform, whether it's Adobe, whether it's a transcript. So that applies to everything.
I mean, I know the answer to this question, we're gonna ask it in this way. How do you do any kind of pre? So you got the whole process, right? You get the SAR, you get the scope sorted out, you get a load of data back from an information search, right? Surely, you know, there must be a deduplication step, because otherwise you might be reviewing the same thing more than once. So, there must be a major trick in trying to dedupe all the data and boil it down into, you know, one set of information.
Yeah.
And the keywords you mentioned earlier is useful to then sort of bundle it up and say, well, this stuff has got these, he's likely to have these types of themes in it or things in it. This stuff is potentially legally privileged. So I've got, you know, quite a lot of questions to ask you, Kathy, but how do you do that deduping? It's not easy, especially if you're manipulating I mean, hundreds of thousands of documents. If you're talking like you've got 10,000 emails or 20,000 emails, you might find you've got, you know, 20,000 attachments as well to those emails. There's a lot of data to be hurling about.
Yeah, well, we tend to, I mean, you know, we tend to not in-house deal with anything under 5,000 pages because it gets, you know, nigh on impossible. However, on the internal software that we use, you know, when we get a set of documents, then yeah, we do send them all as PDFs and we save them all, so you can then start to spot all the same titles. We tend to keep them in, you know, HR.
You're talking about a manual process using something like Adobe,
Because obviously we do both. And you know, and then that said, we then try and dish it out so that, you know, one person is looking at the HR documents and this is what they're looking for, so you know their brief is slightly separate. You know, everything that they do then goes into QA, so that normally gets rid of a lot of duplication. However, the reason I try and put one person on HR and, you know, maybe one person on Excel and one person on attachments is because, you know, if one person is reviewing emails, they've got a good idea. I've seen this email before. Where have I seen it? And that way you tend to get one person who gets very familiar with what's in the HR file and is able to straight away spot the duplicates. Now, all of these documents, regardless of what they are, we log everything, you know, so we log everything that we've received and, you know, what we've done with it. So it's a duplication, you know, it's going to be disclosed, not disclosed. However, anything above 5,000, obviously, we use our third party for. I mean, you know, it's just an amazing.
It's not a third party. We do it. We use a third party platform.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, so the ability that they've got is to, you know, to suck in thousands and thousands of pages. And we, you know, from the client, we set up a criteria of stuff that's to come out of scope, you know, with these, you know, in mind, you know, word searches, you know, disciplinaries, you know, all of that sort of stuff.
So that I mean, what I like about when we use that platform is that it reads each document, doesn't it? And it compares it to each other document in the document set. And if it finds it's an exact duplicate, it'll exclude it from the finished set of documents. So it, again, really quick. Well, I'm saying really quickly, if you throw 100,000 documents in, it takes about a day to do, doesn't it? But you come out with a much cleaner document set. And how am I right? We typically knock about 40% out of a data set if we deduplicate that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And even through the manual process, to be fair, we tend to knock at least half of that out in duplications. You know, I mean, if the client's sensible about it, you know, the first piece of work they should be doing, you know, if it's not particularly a big one, is making sure they can get rid of as much duplication as possible.
So that log you're mentioning, is it the sort of thing you can sort of order the documents by date and by size and by title? So you can start to look for the same thing because it's the same date and the same title. So therefore you can say, well, these are either the same or likely to be the same. So is that how you do it?
Yeah.
Kind of hurling the data about into like a big spreadsheet and looking at it for patterns. Yeah.
Yeah. And that sort of brings us on to the business as usual, which, as you say, causes the biggest headache for everybody because, you know, people, well, Phil and I argue all the time about business as usual, but, you know, people really struggle to understand what personal data is. So a lot of the information that we get, so, which will be attachments generally, either, you know, on our third party software or our own software, we have to, you know, put the attachments in separately and straight away you can see where the duplicates are. But then the next exercise then is, well, are they entitled to this? Well, 95% of the time, these attachments are forecast, finance figures,
budget. It's just like I went to the ICO webinar last week on the children's code, and here's a PowerPoint deck. Well, that's not going to contain any personal data of the requester, is it? But it's in the attachments. It needs reviewing, and it's like, you know, at least 30 seconds of someone's time to review it. And those kind of things is what bogs down a SAR, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's thousands of them. You know, some of these spreadsheets are absolutely massive. And actually, you know, when you get some experience this, you can tell by the name of the document that it's not going to be personal data. Obviously, you do have to have a quick look through it. But then what we find is you've got 30 of this same document with different dates. So straight away, you know that you've got 30 forecasts that are not personal data and can be taken out of the total SAR altogether. And that's a lot of, you know, so. However, I mean, that is a piece of work that has to be done by somebody who understands what business as usual is, because the difference in there, there could also be I don't know, a commission spreadsheet, and that data subject could be in there.
Yeah, good point.
You know, so we have have to be careful when you're just, you know, taking stuff out, because, you know, if you can relate to that spreadsheet, and then there's a chance that there could be personal data in there.
Yeah.
But if it's a board report, then again, it's something that you've got to read, because that data subject might have came up in the board report.
Yeah.
If it's a PowerPoint about, you know, taking over a new business or whatever next year, then the chances are there's not going to be anything personal in there at all. So you can sort of lump all those together, you know, and that's a trick that we sort of learned a long time ago.
Yeah, okay. And I was interested to can pick up that point about training. That training point I want to come back to, I think, is really, really important. You know, what training? It's not just about the GDPR says this or the UK GDPR says this.
Yeah.
And the data protection that says that this is how our process works. This is what you've got to look for. So we'll come back to that one. But I'm interested in when you've got a team reviewing stuff, you know, there's a chance, and we have come across this, haven't we? There's some incredibly contentious or confidential information in this email set or data set. You know, what sort of risks do you get there, Kathy? I mean, you've got people who are potentially reading stuff that they wouldn't otherwise have and shouldn't be entitled to.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you guard against that? I mean, one obvious answer is to outsource the reviewing, but you know, not everyone can do that, can they?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, you do have to be careful, because ideally an employee SAR shouldn't be handled by another employee unless it's probably HR. You know, so we get a lot of that. You know, we get a lot of, you know, I've had an instance, and I can't really go into detail, where, you know, we've been doing a large SAR, but they didn't want one of the other company reviewers to see some of the information. So, you know, we had to have an instruction where we segregated certain information that was, you know, probably financial, salaries, commission, etc., segregated that separately so that somebody else could QA it and not another third party. So, you know, we've come across a lot of that. So employee SARs are much more difficult, because you've got to be very careful who you give it to. And, you know, as I say, we have had a lot of that. I mean, the only other thing that I probably haven't mentioned is, you know, external SARs. So, you know, that's a whole other ball game, because at the end of the day, you can't really insist that an external person fills in your internal form. You know, so again, that person, data subject, can ask for a request verbally, by email, by telephone. Most people don't mind being asked to follow it up on an email, which I suggest is the best, you know, best way forward, because you want to capture what that person's asking for and also be able to go back to them and clarify if you're not sure. But then the internal scoping form should still apply. Because obviously you're asking somebody, you know, internally, including IT and HR, this is the data that they've got to look for, this is what they've got to find, etc. And then you're also letting the reviewers know what you're looking for. So, you know, that's the only two differences in an internal and an external SAR, that you can't insist to fill in a form. You've got to accept, you know, whatever is their preferred method for requesting it.
Yeah, we talk about training again in a second, but you've mentioned a few times that spreadsheets of this and overviews of that. So what's your thoughts on record keeping? So in the good old days, I mean talking like 10 or 15 years ago, I remember doing SARS with my old colleague Joe Colleran, and we used to keep an Excel sheet of every single document we received and blah 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 blah. So, you know, a really comprehensive case file, we used to call it. And on a number of occasions, the ICO kind of, somebody complained to the ICO, they called in the SAR and they said, you know, show us what you've got. And we sent over the case file. And every single time we had that level of documentation, you know, the ICO said, well, it looks like a good process to me, irrespective of whether we had, you know, on the client's instruction, deliberately hidden data or not. So, you know, my view has always been, if you've got a really good looking process that's got, you know, good output and is well controlled, or at least it looks well controlled, then, you know, you've got a strong position to defend if you get challenged. So what sort of record keeping do you think, you know, are the keys, Kathy?
Exactly what you've just described. So on both, we have that. So we, you know, we have an internal log of, you know, documents received, you know, what that document was, how many pages was it, what was the title of it, and what was the outcome? You know, is it to be disclosed? Is it redacted to be disclosed? Is it not to be disclosed? Why is it not to be disclosed? So we have all that. On the third-party software, we also have probably an easier way of doing it, because again, we can just pull out reports from
logs, it logs automatically, doesn't it? In fact, yeah, it logs every time anybody opens a document and what they've done with it.
You know, you can, I can go into a document, I can find out who's reviewed it, I can find out who QA'd it, I can find out when it's done. So you're able to pinpoint, you know, who's done what. It also, you know, if I wanted to report on all the financial documents that are in there, so say forecast 1990 or just forecast, I could pull out a report on all the forecast documents that are in there, and you could see that, you know, you've got 20,000 documents that are just numbers. You know, so we've got a very good reporting system, and obviously at the end of the work that we've done, we provide that to the client. So ideally, we don't want to be keeping the data for longer than we have to. So, you know, when the job is actually finished, we provide the client with the log, with all the documents to be disclosed, not to be disclosed, etc. So they've got everything, obviously, in case the subject access person, the date subject comes back. We tend to keep them for at least 6 months, so that if the client comes back to us and we need to revisit it, then obviously we can. And it's the same with our, you know, with our platform. You know, whatever comes off the platform, we have our own copy of it, so we save it. So, you know, it certainly doesn't disappear off there. You know, it comes into our shared filed area and we treat it as normal. You know, 6 months, let us know when we can delete the content.
Yeah. Let's talk about trading then, because, you know, if you're like a local authority potential, and you're getting hundreds and literally hundreds of FOIA requests a month, you can see that you can, you know, stabilize your process, train a team, you know, and it's worth investing in that. But if you're only getting, you know, a handful of SARs a year, there's always going to be a reluctance. And I think I would probably be in this camp as well if I was only in a business only getting a couple of SARs a year, if ever. Yeah, you know, taking the time to think it through, to work it through, to build a team. Because I've always advocated, well, you should really do a test run. You know, simulate getting a SAR, do a search, and see what you get. Because out of it, you'll think, crikey, we need to look at our retention policy. We've got emails dating back 20 years in some cases, haven't we, in these SARs? So, what sort of training do you suggest people do, Kathy? You know.
Well, there's sort of two questions in there. So the training sort of obviously is an issue, but the retention is probably the biggest issue going at the moment for everybody, because people, they just don't connect the two. So, you know, people are still these days, you know, sending round, you know, forecasts, you know, however weekly that you've got to send them to accounts. You know, why don't they just have an accounts email? Why, you know, why don't they just have an account shared folder where, you know, you don't have to send an email every week to say that this week's forecast is in the shared folder? Because, you know, if you're sending that to a person who then puts in a data, a SAR request, all that gets captured because it's in their name, you know, so, and people just don't relate that. And why would they relate that to a, you know, a data subject requesting information that, you know, that's relevant to them? Emails again, you know, how many companies tell their teams to review their emails every 6 months and delete old emails? You know, how many companies does the IT, you know, automatically delete emails after a certain time? You know, we've had companies that have had a retention of 25 years and they've had people working for them that long, and then they get a SAR request and they wonder why it takes 6 months to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not helping themselves.
Yeah, there's a few questions in the chat. People are asking kind of tools and you know, saying what they do. So what we've done in the past, Kathy, again, correct me if I'm wrong, is when we receive the boxes of paperwork, we ship it off to a trusted supplier to have it scanned and converted to PDFs, don't we? That's how we then we can load it into DC or into our online platform. So we do use it over DC. I hate it. I think it's awful because you've got no audit trail on it. But the third-party platform we use is called Nuix, and it's a forensic, you know, analysis platform. And it's very, very expensive, and it's very hard to justify if you're not getting many big SARs a year. In fact, we don't put any big SARs through, any small SARs through it, because we can't pass the cost on to the customers, can we?
No, and to be fair, I mean, exactly what you said, we'd all prepared to use Nuix, you know, most of the time. But in all honesty, some of the small SARs, I mean, we get some that are 400 or 500 pages, you know, I mean, we can do them in a sleep, You know, it doesn't take, you know, they're not, I know you don't like them, but, you know, the audit trail's quite good, and touch wood so far in 18 months, we've never had a problem.
Oh, no, the audit trail is fine because it's produced by people, but I like technology producing the audit trails.
I do. But, you know, not everybody can afford Nuix, you know, albeit it's, you know, it's fantastic. But at the end of the day, the client don't care. They just want the SAR done at the most cost effective, efficient way. Adobe is probably not the best, but we do have other bits of software that we use as well for transcripts and, you know, for calls, etc. So, you know, it does, it works for us. But it just depends on how many you get. You know, we're lucky that we're constantly keeping reviewers and QAs going with SARS. But, you know, that's taken us 18 months to build up. And obviously, we're very grateful to people that put the work through us. But some companies might only get a couple every now and again. But when they get them, they could be huge.
Yeah. I've got other questions that aren't related to SARS. We'll try and pick those up in a minute. What's your kind of your kind of nemesis, if you like, in SAR land? What is the thing that you think is the absolute killer? Is there one thing you can pin it?
Probably not, but there's several things. One is get a very good, thorough policy and procedure that, you know, that relates to the law and covers the law, and that everybody who's going to be dealing with SARS understands it. You know, make sure that you get a very, very good scope, and make sure that those that are doing the reviewing and the QAing totally understand the brief. Training and, you know, the QA process is so important. And probably the hardest things to put in place. And, you know, hence why, you know, if you're only getting one or two, why bother? Why just send them to us? Because it's not worth you getting your head round all the information that you need to get round. But if you're getting quite a lot, and obviously cost-wise you can't afford to outsource it, then make sure you get your ducks in a row.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything, I mean, we can pick up some of these questions, Kathy. Is there anything else that we need to say, you know, or summarise in terms of, if we've said seven key things, seven ways to simplify SARS?
Well, I've sort of covered a lot of it. I mean, there's much more to say on a lot, such as transfer of data. You know, don't be emailing documents to each other that are, you know, that are going to be reviewed. Make sure that you've got them in a shared folder. You know, make sure that when you send them out to the data subject, the password protected, or, you know, posted, whatever. I mean, even posts, we've had lots go missing. You know, make sure that you're doing regular training. So, you know, we have our reviewers train every time we get a SAR. We have a training session, remind them of the law, and then obviously a really good brief on the work that we're doing and what they're looking for, and make sure they're all redacting it exactly the same way, and like attachments. I mean, that's a big one. So if an email says, "Hey, Catherine, here is your forecast attachment for this week," that's going to get picked up.
It is in the search, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So we take out the word attachment, I mean, because document's somewhere else.
Yeah. Joe Lewis raised a really good valid point here that emails to, from, you know, or to or from the requester, so to CC, BCC, etc. Again, we Joe said the ICO's advice is ask the data subject whether they want them. Effectively, they've already had them, so therefore they don't necessarily need to provide them again. Yeah. If they're a current employee, you could probably take that approach. If they're a past employee, there is case law where the courts have ruled that not giving them access to their emails has been problematic. But as a matter of course, we generally take the view that if they've had it before, then we exclude them from the initial work, don't we? So we're looking for the things that they haven't seen before to provide them with rather than the things they have.
That usually would be in the form. So the form up front would say, do you want us to provide, you know, do you want to leave in scope two, from, and CC, or can we take it out of scope to assume they've already had it? Obviously that takes it, but, you know, a lot
saying
of people,
that Kathy, so saying that, I was gonna say, saying that three of our customers in the last 12 months have again, they've taken an opposite approach. It's like, well, I'm going to swamp the person with emails and other documents, and then they're not going to find the smoking gun.
So if I'm dealing with a company and I'm miffed for whatever reason, I'm not going to make life easy for them, am I? So
no, you know, but equally, the company won't make life easy for you, because they'll provide you back with 100,000 emails in individually paged PDFs, you know, electronically, and you'll have to go through them all. So we've seen it where people have taken the opposite approach. Like, well, I'm gonna bury you in paperwork for a couple of years.
We have that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. A couple of questions about retention of SARS. Well, I mean, I think that's been answered by the group. So the ICO recommends 24 months. Thank you, Jason, for that. Let me just quickly scan through. Can you keep talking? I'm looking through the questions, Kathy. Okay. Or unless you want to start talking, Dave and Ollie, wrapping up, any final points or things you want to...
Yeah, well, I've covered in the training, you know, exemptions and stuff like that, which is, as you know, it's a very difficult subject to do. So, you know, we don't really expect all our reviewers to understand all the exemptions because, you know, it's our job as consultants to understand that. However, we do give them training on it so that they can identify it and, you know, understand that this part's got to be put in a separate folder for us to look at and get a second opinion. You know, again, this is all down to training. The QAs, obviously, they have a different level of training than the reviewers. So, you know, exemptions is, you know, we drill that down to them as much as they can. And, you know, most of our QAs, you can spot them a mile off now, which is really good.
One of the things we haven't talked about, Rick Mannix has raised this kind of manifestly unfounded and excessive card. We haven't talked about that really because that's a fairly simple, well, it's a very difficult thing to prove whether something manifestly unfounded. Yeah. And at the moment, it's quite tricky to prove it, that the request itself is excessive. And the courts are undecided on whether there is this kind of how the notion of proportionality works. Well, I think the courts are clear, but they work 100%. 180 degrees opposite to where the ICO's view is, which is, you know, even backup tapes are included in quantity ICO's guidance, whereas the courts say just undertake a proportional search. So we haven't mentioned that because you have to treat each case on its own merits, don't you?
But we have had a couple of those where, you know, the data subject has gone back to the ICO to say that they don't believe that they've been provided with everything. You know, whoever they've been dealing with has said that, you know, there were too much information there, et cetera, and they needed better data. And we've had to revisit again. I think every case is totally different. And the only time that it really becomes clear that it is unfounded is when a data subject is constantly asking for information. So, you know, every 3 months or every 6 months, they want the last 3 months or they want the last 6 months. But I've not come across one yet where it's been proved. It's unfound, so it's a difficult one. Is that?
Yeah, somebody's mentioned Objective Red Cat as a tool. Objective Red Act. I've not seen that as a tool. Have you, Kathy?
I have briefly come across it when I was looking. It seems to be quite a good tool. I've not compared the two, but funny enough, that and two others are on my list to start having a look at because obviously we're always trying to improve what we've got. But yes, that has come up as a few, and I believe that you can put any document into that, so it can be a PST file, whereas Adobe, as you probably know, it's all PDFs.
Just PDFs, yeah. So, yeah. So Gavin's asking about call recordings. Again, we get these to deal with, don't we? And we either listen to them or we get them transcribed. You know, there's good software that can transcribe them. But I think you don't have to provide the call recordings. It's the same. In theory, you're not providing or required to provide documents under a SAR. You're required to provide personal data. So, you know, they don't actually have to have the call recording. They have to have the personal data contained within the call recording, which is often easier to put out there as a transcript. Yeah. And I remember
Sorry, Phil. If I may, I would just add on that point because I've spoken to the ICO about this a number of times, and you're absolutely right that we're talking about personal data and not documents. But obviously. Whereas a call recording, you have things which can alter the content of that document. So if it's a call recording, tone can be quite significant in voice. Yeah. So if you're being aggressive or anything.
Yeah.
So I've spoken to the ICO about it, and they've said that in theory, it is possible for individuals to ask for a recording over a transcript on that basis.
Right. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, because you could sound angry, couldn't you, on the call?
Yeah, exactly.
That's not going to relate into a transcript. I mean, to be fair, we've not really been asked to transcript calls. What we've been asked to do is redact and review the calls and take out, you know, any third parties or other names mentioned. I think.
Yeah, on the small, when we're doing small scale, again, like single recordings, short recordings, we use Audacity, don't we? That it's basically a free audio studio, basically, that you can use to listen to the transcript and then record over the top of bits of it. So that's a really useful tool for doing that. And Ollie was a bit of a wizard at it, weren't you, last year?
Yeah,
unfortunately, which which meant I kept getting saddled with
he used to pull his hair out every time you mentioned it. So, you know, if anybody who's listening, it's certainly not a job that you want to be doing unless you really have to, let me tell you.
No, I've got the job now. Thanks, Ollie.
Good when you pipe up.
There's lots of questions actually today. Toby's saying, wouldn't all, back to emails, wouldn't all CC and two emails count as personal data? Well, they count as documents that have been shared with a data subject, the requester, but they don't necessarily contain their personal data. Definitely. And if it's to them, but then is not relating to them, you know, the content doesn't relate to them, then that document isn't personal data. It doesn't comprise personal data. So we're right back to the heart of the definition of what is personal data, aren't we?
Yeah, this is the scenario that we get all the time. And when you're training reviewers up, it is quite difficult because they think, well, they've sent it to them. Well, yeah, they've sent it to them, but it's about a forecast that they've produced or a commission statement they've produced for a housing organisation, or it's a housing list. It's not personal data. It's part of their role and their job role, and they're not entitled to it. You know, if that email then refers on, oh, what did you have for tea last night? Are we cooking tonight? Are we off to the pub? Then that part of the email, yes, that would become personal data. But the information contained within it, if it's a tenancy list or, you know, it's a billing list, it's not personal data.
Yeah. Quick one here. This is really important. We cover this. Well, Chris Jones asking about fees. So in the old days, there was a standard fee, you know, minimum £10. I think health records was 130. Education records was, I think, 80, was it? Mm-hmm. And that the kind of automatic administration fee was removed within the GDPR. But there is the ability to charge a fee for manifestly unfounded or excessive requests. Mm-hmm. But the Data Protection Act, and Matthew will know because he's just done this work on it, sets out guidance around the level of fees that can be charged for SARs. So the GDPR and the UK GDPR says you can charge a fee in these circumstances. You can either refuse to respond or to fulfill, should I say, a manifestly unfounded or excessive request, or charge a fee for it. And then you have to refer to the Data Protection Act, one of the sections 170 or something, which then sets out, you know, what the fees should be or can be. You know, so yes, you can charge a fee, but you know, the process would be you get a request, you go back to them, say it's manifestly unfounded or manifestly excessive, and we're going to charge you a fee, or we'll refuse, you know, and then they'll come back and challenge you on it. So it's not quite the same as it was, is it?
Yeah, there's a couple of things to consider in there. So first of all, if you're going to have a big employee SAR, the things that you should remember is, obviously we all know that, you know, ideally a company's going to try and pay off that employee if it's a big SAR and there's a lot of stuff in there. However, if you look at it, you know, realistically, you know, 40% of that information that's come up in their search is not relevant. So, you know, a lot of people start off by paying off the employee first of all, when in actually, you know, doing the SAR and doing it correctly, you know, it's going to cost them a lot less money. And I do also know that some clients that I've dealt with have got some sort of insurance now. I don't know if it's part of the indemnity, but it does cover sort of security breaches, incidents, and I believe subject access requests. Now, I would have to look into that a bit more, but I do know of some clients that have got that. So I suppose you've got a bit of a protection. But I've not come across a case yet where, you know, they've ruled on the side of the, you know, of the client, you know, that it is too big or unfoundly or you need to charge them. Have you?
Well, not under the GDPR, the UK Data Protection Act. Obviously, a couple of cases the courts have ruled on under the 98 Act, but not under the 18 Act, where they have said, you know, I mean, the D of the University of Oxford is one that springs to mind, where the University of Oxford, I think, looked at 500,000 pages and according to Dr. Deer, missed a few pages out, and the courts ruled that they'd done a proportionate search and found it in their favour. But these are edge cases that I'm not sure we could take any, you know, kind of mainstream guidance from. Elaine's asking about call recordings, you know, if the customer wants a postal response, I guess, you know, you just put it onto a DVD, won't you? And then probably password protect it in case it goes missing in the post, and then, you know, ship it out to them. But again, you always got to be really careful on the security of how you're
We've had a couple go missing. We've had some send it out on a memory stick and then, you know, send the password with it and, you know, all things not to do. I mean, if you've got to send it, some people like paper and that's just how it is. But, you know, if you're going to send it out, it needs to be recorded. It needs to be signed. I won't send out paper copies. I would send, you know, some people say, well, I ain't got a laptop. I ain't got a computer. It needs to be on paper. Well, get them to come and collect it then. You know, because we have had some go missing and it causes a lot of grief. Yeah, putting on a memory stick is a good idea. Password protect it and send the password through separately. But yeah, there's loads of different ways.
Right, ask him to drink for it. Now, Miles is saying which is quite right, need to talk about these polls. I can't see the results, though, Miles. Can you see the results of the polls? Oh, yeah, I can. I've got to click view results.
I get to publish results first. I don't think the poll's working for some people.
Right. Well, the really, really quickly, the most popular redaction tool in use according to the survey on these people is Adobe. A PDF redaction tool such as Adobe. Yeah. A few people use a platform like we've suggested here, Nuix. Yeah. And then a few people still offer for paper using Indelible Markers. I've always found Tippex was the better option there. Tippex strips. Tippex strips in the past, you know, back in the day. Again, most people are saying that their teams have got a good knowledge. So in terms of, you know, how do people know their way around the exemptions? 9% saying pretty much expert, and then 46% good knowledge, 42 some knowledge. Nobody said, wait, what, exemptions? Which is good. So that's really encouraging that you know, people have understood what they are.
Seriously, which is great.
I'm just reading the next question. Most people again have got half 53% have got training in hand, which is again really good. They've got something arranged. Some surprising number, if I may say so, 38% have said we haven't really done any training, but we'll deal with it as and when we get a request, which was suggested that they don't get requests, which is fine. But you know, yeah. And in terms of people's view of data retention, most people say, or 48% say, it's a challenge. I think it's a challenge everywhere. I'd like to talk to the people who've said it's a doddle. I don't know.
It's totally changing your education of where you do and how you communicate with people. So it is a big learning curve.
Yeah. And again, surprisingly, there's majority of people, like 52% who've responded, have said that they get five or fewer SARs a month, and 13% more than 20. So that's probably not surprising given the nature of the audience. That's probably what you'd expect. Just gone up 54%. So interesting there to kind of, you know, see where we are in terms of, you know, everybody else, if this is a representative group. Kathy, I'm going to do your duty. We're running out of time, I'm afraid. It's 2:25. So we probably need to wrap up.
Yeah, but if anybody's got any questions, you know, just email the support inbox at Data Protection People and we'll help you if we can. Obviously, the SAR spot is always popular because it's everybody's nightmare. But just one word of warning, whoever's doing your SAR review, be patient and be understanding because it's not an easy job. And, you know, it takes a lot of commitment and, you know, attention to detail.
It is hard, isn't it? We've all done it and it's a tough job. Yeah, it's a tough job. So without further discussion, Dave, Ollie, anything further to say before we dive off?
Ollie's gone. I'm going to have to jump on a meeting with him in a minute. But I thought it was really interesting from my point, and kind of just maybe reiterating what you've said today. In order to help simplify SARs, I've kind of looked at it in three different brackets. So simplify it through looking at technical aspects, and in order to look at technical aspects, that then relates to training. So have you got sufficient training and understand some of the really technical nature, whether it's what is personal data or whether it's trying to understand whether we should apply redactions as a blanket exemption or whether we should actually do the assessment of what is reasonable to disclose, what isn't, and should I get consent. So that all relates to appropriate understanding and training. If you want to try and simplify SR because you've got too much data, well, the obvious one is then apply your retention schedules and start deleting stuff, because that will reduce the volume naturally. And in relation to deleting stuff as well as the duplications, whether you can start looking at what Cathy mentioned in relation to, let's not start emailing copies of documents to various different people. Can we find different ways of doing the same thing? Whether it's using a common filing structure and just highlighting actually the files in a common filing structure, because that will then naturally limit how many times that document is produced when you do your search. And likewise, then just simplify the process. Is the process for the SOW, does it work? Have you stress tested it? What happens, or is your SOW process capable of being scalable? So if you had a sufficiently serious breach, and we've seen it with some clients where the number of SARs then rocket as a consequence of the breach, generally led through claims management companies all putting in for compensation. Does the process that you have in place, or is the process that you have in place, capable of being scaled up should you suddenly find an influx of details because of a problem? And that may also help to simplify the process, because you need to make sure that the process is working efficiently for you.
Yeah, totally.
Good.
Wonderful.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm afraid that's probably all we've got time for. So thank you very much, Cathy, for your time, your insight, and preparing for this. Thanks, Dave, for your contribution, and Ollie in his absence. Next week, we're going to attempt to do 6 hours worth of broadcasting on International Data Protection Day, which is the 28th of January. So I better get some lozenges stocked up on.
You reminded me on that, Phil. I need to put in a day's leave.
Refused. So thank you very much, everyone, for joining. Thanks for your contributions, and those who've been answering the questions that have been raised, thank you for that as well. We hope to see you next week, and in the meantime, have a great weekend, and again, thank you for participating.
All right, all. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you all. Take care. Bye-bye.